Well, the bottom line was that the buildup after the 1932-33 battle for the chancellery, which, of course, Hitler was able to take from his, well, actually, he killed his way into it, from what I understand, but he was financed, his war machine, his buildup was financed by these bankers, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Max Warburg and Max Oppenheimer financed everything. And they put out a mythical story that German industrialists had financed Hitler, which wasn't true. The German industrialists didn't like him and they had nothing to do with him. All of his money came from Jewish bankers, which created a paradoxical situation that you had an anti-Semitic government, which was attacking the Jews, and it was all financed with Jewish money.
Well, now, at the time, was anybody aware over the, you know, was this above board, or was this kind of clandestine financing?
Oh, this was clandestine. In fact, Aldi came into it years later after World War II. George Sylvester Viereck told me a lot of it. See, he was the illegitimate son of Kaiser Wilhelm I.
Who was?
George Sylvester Viereck. He represented Germany during both World Wars. I used to kid him that he cost Germany victory in both World Wars, and he was quite flattered when I told him that.
And was he from the same Zionist camp?
Oh, no, he was old European aristocracy.
Ah, okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, I got a few other questions about Mr. Friedman. Anyway, then I want to move over to Mr. Untermyer, as well as Mr. Fagan. Ladies and gentlemen, when we return, we have a great resource in Eustace Mullins. Stick with us. And ladies and gentlemen, we're back. Daryl Bradford Smith, your host today. Got a great interview going on, but to give you my details here, IamTheWitness.com is the website. And these subjects we're talking about are all available on that site, including Benjamin Friedman, Samuel Untermyer's transcript, as well as Myron Fagan's work. We're going to go back to Ben Friedman's work here. He talks about World War II, the destruction and all of the things that happened in World War II, being designed in order to get an exodus of the Jewish community from Europe. In other words, there was no event that was going to get them to migrate to the Middle East, to Palestine, and that these people, these megalomaniacs in charge, came up with a scheme that by having this hatred generated against the Jewish community, somehow they would get an exodus of this community, and by and large, it worked, didn't it?
Oh, yes. In fact, Hitler was recruited by the World Zionist Organization in 1923. He had this little movement in Germany that wasn't going anywhere, and the World Zionist Organization cut a deal with him in 1923. They joined and worked together, and that's how the Nazi Party was created. So you see, the Holocaust itself was created entirely in the Jewish community. The rest of the world had no problem with Jewish people whatsoever.
Well, their goal, though, was to get a population of them to get back into Palestine and then to exercise that Balfour agreement they had made with the British so that a homeland could be established. To what end was this being done? Why were they trying to set up this homeland, Eustace, in your view?
Well, they figured this homeland was at the crossroads of the world, and that it would control the entire world. That's what it was about. It was about world domination. They weren't just looking for a homeland for the Jewish people. They were looking to dominate the world. You could do it from the crossroads of the world in Palestine.
Are there religious overtones to this?
I have never found any religious overtones in everything. Everything is practical politics. Everybody's after money and power. I haven't run into religious people at all.
You haven't, but they do use religion as a smokescreen, don't they?
Well, they always use religion. Religion is a perfect smokescreen because you can say whatever you're doing for God, and who could criticize you for that?
Well, that seems to be what's happened then.
Oh, yeah, exactly what happened.
Well, and I also understand that there are nonsensical ideas that they want to reestablish the Temple Mount after they've consolidated their power in the Middle East.
They certainly do. All those plans are in that formation right now.
They are.
Oh, yes.
And to reestablish that Temple Mount to who welcomed the Rothschilds to the leadership role in that area?
Well, the Rothschilds had the leadership role in that area since 1880. The whole idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine was financed by the Rothschilds from Vienna in 1880. See, there was never a penny put up by the Jewish community itself for settling in Palestine because the Jews were very happy in Europe. They had no reason to go to Palestine. If you're living in a beautiful modern city, why would you want to go live in a desert? I mean, they're not crazy.
Well, that makes sense. And a desert, in fact, that is being fought over.
Oh, yes. Still being fought over because it's still a crucial area of the world. You control Europe and Asia from that area.
Yeah.
So geopolitically, it makes sense. It doesn't make sense from economic sense. It does make sense even from geography. You have to know geopolitical goals in order to understand what's going on with that. And the American people have no conceptions of geopolitics whatsoever.
Yeah, that's pretty evident. Now let's go to Myron Fagan's work here. He actually does a chronology or a timeline, as it were, for what he describes, not Zionism. He describes it more as the Illuminati or these consul on foreign relations. But aren't these just creations of the same Zionist leadership?
Oh, yes. The Illuminati and Freemasons all came out of the Rothschilds in Vienna, Austria. And, Myron was trying to focus on the conspiratorial angle of the thing. He was a very brilliant man and one of the finest people I ever met in my life. He was the only person for years who would promote my Federal Reserve book, which appeared in 1953, and it was really immediately in the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith unleashed a national campaign against the book. They labeled it as virulently anti-Semitic and myself as the worst anti-Semite in history. So they never quit. They're still saying what they said in 1953, that my book is anti-Semitic. And people read it, pick it up and read it, they can't find an anti-Semitic word in it, so it really puzzles them. But Byron went against the whole establishment because he was an honest man and he believed in what he was doing, and he did it all his life. I knew him in his last years. He had finally left California for New York, and he was living in a one-room place in New York in a poor section, and his home was broken into almost every day.
And ladies and gentlemen, we're back. We've got a short segment here before our top of the hour break. They're used to, they'll have a couple of minutes to get a cup of tea or something at the top of the hour. But before we go to that break, I want to ask you a couple of questions here. About Ezra Pound, what happened to Ezra, and what did they try to do to this man? They really tried to crush him. And what's the significance of his work in this whole thing?
Well, you know, Ezra was a completely free agent. He was belonged to no political party and never espoused any kind of political feeling in his life. He was loyal to the Constitution of the United States, and he maintained his American citizenship. And all the years he lived in Italy, he was a loyal American. And that's how they indicted him for treason, because he was a loyal American. If he'd given up his American citizenship, they could never have touched him.
Well, what were the reasons for indicting him?
He was indicted by Alger Hiss, who was a specialist in treason. See, he was a personal assistant to Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was a KGB agent. And Ezra was quite anti-communist in those days, which most everybody was. I was, too. And he was very critical of the communist slave system. So,
communism is a fabrication of this group in order to de-godify the population or de-religify the population, if there is such a word, and also to make people believe that there is no difference between the effort of one as opposed to another, thereby destroying anybody's personal drive in life And it's a disastrous philosophy that they invented, isn't it?
It's totally invented. In fact, the Rothschilds invented Zionism, fascism, Nazism, and communism all in 1830 in Germany. And it's not a dime's worth of difference between any of them.
Well, when we talk about this left-right difference in our political system and all the fighting that's going on, what Myron Fagan talks about is that these are fights that they propagate in order to keep people separated from each other so that no one ever fights the real fight, which is the haves against the have-nots and the powerful elite against the sheeple, the slaves down below. And that is still very much in force, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. In fact, this talk about left and right is total nonsense. It never has been anything but nonsense. I have never met an extreme right-wing person in the United States, unless he was a double agent posing as an extreme right-wing person, which is usually the case.
Well, but now what we've got here is they also do this with races. They do it between blacks and
religion,
Jews and blacks and whites.
Absolutely.
And so forth.
These are created out of nothing. Why, here in the South, before 1940, blacks and whites got along very well together. But all of this was created after World War II, the so-called schism between blacks and white people at the South. It has and the Ku Klux Klan, which is a Masonic organization, the Grand Kleagle and all that, these are Masonic terms. And that was created to drive a wedge between blacks and whites in this, all throughout this country, and it still exists.
Yes, it does. I'd like to talk a little bit when we come back after the break about Albert Pike as well.
Oh, yes.
And some of his, the letters from Albert Pike that are claimed to be a possible forgeries. When we return, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a six-minute break. We've got lots more from Eustace Mullins. Please, stick with The French Connection. Yeah, here, I want to go on to another fellow here that's very instrumental in this because he never did turn sides. He was always on the bad guy's side. His name is Untermyer.
Oh, Sammy Untermyer, yeah.
Yeah, and he was as tied into this as you can get. And he did a 1933 speech, boy, that I've got the transcript on my website here. It is very powerful in the way he uses the lie of the day to explain to his constituency within the Jewish Zionist community. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask Eustace about this gentleman, Untermyer, this guy, this crazy man here, and see what we can't put together about him when we return on The French Connection. And ladies and gentlemen, we are back with our special guest today, Eustace Mullins. Eustace is a real resource, and he's a first person witness to much of what we're discussing today, and the names and times of early on in this fight against world Zionism. It's been around for hundreds of years in its present manifestations, but it has its roots over the millennia almost. I mean, these folks have been fermenting problems dating back to as far back as the Spanish Inquisition and before, haven't they?
Oh, yes, indeed. There's nothing new here because their plans have never changed over the centuries. They remained consistent and committed to their plans, and they're going to go ahead with them regardless of anything.
Boy, you know, now how does Mr. Untermyer figure into all these activities?
Well, he was a key financial and lawyer to the big bankers in New York City. He put together deals for Bernard Baruch and the Rothschilds. He merged some of the biggest companies in the United States. And he charged enormous fees, $2 or $3 billion a fee. And he became a multi-billionaire many times over. He lived like a king. He had 60 gardeners at his estate outside of New York City.
Jesus. Well, he comes back from his European visit in 1933, announcing to the Jewish group that was the Zionist group that was meeting that day that he was successful in beginning the the destruction of the German people, and that he was working on that boycott of their products. And yes. Boy, does he was venomous about what he wanted them to do.
Oh, he really was. He was a venomous person, and that was a declaration of war against Germany in 1933. So World War II was actually inaugurated by Sammy Unterbacher in New York in 1933.
Yeah, that was the day that that the war was actually declared, wasn't it, against the German people?
That was war. That was a declaration of war.
Now, the fact that Hitler was stupid enough, or did he not, or did he know, that he was making a deal with Stalin not to have a non-aggression pact, and then turned around and went against that. Why? They were both being supported by the same group. Stalin had his Zionist money supporters, and so did Hitler.
Well, because anybody these people support, they support you to give a territory, but you cannot encroach on somebody else's territory. You see, when Hitler invaded Russia in June 1941, it was to stop Stalin from invading Germany in 1941, because Stalin had already committed all of his troops to attack Germany in September of 41.
So Barbarossa was a plan to beat Stalin to the attack.
That's right. It was a blitzkrieg, which was intended to be launched before Stalin hit him. It was rival gangs fighting over the same territory.
And both of them being financed, again, two sides of a war being financed by the same megalomaniacs.
Oh, yes. Well, you cannot really have a war unless you finance those sides, because it's very hard to start wars. Most people don't want to go to war. And therefore, you have to finance two sides to get them to fight each other.
Is that happening in Iraq right now?
Oh, certainly. We were dealing with Iraq all along, you know. Saddam Hussein was on the CIA payroll for 40 years, and the Bushes supported him all the way.
Now, who's in charge of America right now? I know George Bush and family are just underlings of these people.
Oh, yeah, they're lackeys. I used to tell people that the Rothschilds financed the Harrimans in the Union Pacific Railroad, and they financed John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. So they were just puppets of the Rothschilds.
And they're not even way up on the food chain, are they?
Oh, no. In fact, I don't think they participate in the important councils at all. They just do what they're told.
Uh-huh. And who are some of the others that are doing it today in our country?
Well, it's the old families. You know, there's five Italian families that have controlled the papacy since 1825. It was the Medici and three or four other families. They're well known in Italy.
But who's in control of the United States right now, Eustace?
Well, when you look at it, it almost looks like nobody is in control. The American people certainly are in control. They're totally out of control.
Well, but I mean, what families right now are controlling the strings?
Well, it's right out of Europe and the Rothschilds. But the families they're using here are the Schiffs and the Warburgs and the Rockefellers and people like that.
And how about the Goldmans and the Lehmans and the Kahn and
They're all Wall Street stooges. That's all they are. They're just brokers on Wall Street. They don't have any real power. They make a lot of money. They make $100 billion a year apiece, but they don't really have any power. No, the decisions are made from higher up.
And the higher up is between Warburg and Rothschild.
Oh, that's exactly right. You're talking business now.
And those families intermarry, don't they?
They do. They intermarry constantly. And in fact, they are more conscious of marriages than the royal families of Europe. Any marriage between members of those families is a business merger. That's all it is.
Really? And who is the lead component of that family today?
The lead component?
Of the Rothschild fortune. Is it the British part of it?
The British who?
There are three parts of the family. Some of them live in Zurich, some live in London, and some live in France.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're pretty well evenly matched. For quite a few years, 1920 to 1940, the Rothschilds were financed by the British and were controlled by the French branch. But they're out of power now. They were controlled after that by the London base. I think it's still being run out of London.
And are those, is that the same guy that this Edward there that you see pictures of Governor Schwarzenegger there standing beside and Warren Buffett taking pictures with? Is that the guy that's in charge?
For a long time, there was a guy named Goldsmith, Jimmy Goldsmith, but he died, and I don't know exactly who's running the show right now.
Well, it seems to me all the intermarriage would start affecting their intellect. Is that happening?
Well, it probably does, and it probably has. They don't particularly show any intellect. They're just doing the same thing over and over again. They're not coming out with anything new, and that's why they're so predictable.
But how the heck do they get away with it so cleverly? I mean, how do they do it?
Well,
how come the public can't get their brains around this problem?
They've got control of capital. They've got control of the seats of power. And the public cannot get their foot in the door.
Have we ever had our foot in the door, ever?
Well, we've had our foot in the door a couple of times. We had it with Andrew Jackson, and we had it with people like Thomas Jefferson. There's been people who turned up sometime that did some good. Now, Ezra Pound used to tell me that the last decent American president was Calvin Coolidge. He was a New England boy who became president. He was a very good president. But since then, it's all been downhill.
Oh, boy. Well, when we come back, we're going to have one more segment with Eustace, and we're going to discuss a couple of extra things that we have on our minds here today on The French Connection. When we return, more from Eustace Mullen.